Thank you, Prem. Thank you, Ganesh. And dear listeners, Sai Ram from Prashantanalayam, the most happening place on the planet, as I always say. And today is January 29th. So the first month of the new year, 2015, is drawing to a close. But before that happens, will arrive a very significant day. A day which means a lot to Indians, as well as to thousands of others in other lands and countries who believe in truth and non-violence. A day when we remember one of the greatest sons of Mother India, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, Gandhi, who was conferred the title Mahatma, which means the great soul, by the people of this nation. In fact, early in the morning of January 30th, 1948, almost foreseeing the manner of his death, Gandhiji had said to one of his caretakers, "If someone fires bullets at me and I die without a groan and with God's name on my lips, only then you should tell the world that here was a real Mahatma." Because people had already started calling him Mahatma, but he felt he deserved that title only if God's name danced on his lips. Even if a bullet shot through his chest. And that is exactly how it happened. As the third shot was fired from point blank range at Gandhiji's chest, he stood still, his palms joined. And then the words, "Hey Ram, Hey Ram," almost instantaneously escaped from his lips. He slowly sank to the ground, but his palms were still joined, possibly in a final, ultimate act of non-violence and prayer. It was 5:17 p.m. January 30th. He had indeed journeyed from being an ordinary young man to becoming a Mahatma. He had truly journeyed from untruth to truth, from darkness to light, from death to immortality. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the American pastor, activist, humanitarian, and the leader in the African-American civil rights movement of 1960s, who is best known for his huge role in the advancement of civil rights of black Americans, is the unique thing about his movement was using this non-violent civil disobedience based on his Christian beliefs. And his courage and inspiration to follow this path of civil disobedience in a non-violent manner was Gandhiji. Gandhiji was his inspiration. In fact, on the 10th anniversary of the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, this is what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said as a tribute to this great man. And I quote, "Mahatma Gandhi has done more than any other person of history to reveal that social problems can be solved without resorting to primitive methods of violence. In this sense, he is more than a saint of India. He belongs, as they said of Abraham Lincoln, he belongs to the ages." He continues, "In our struggle against racial segregation in Alabama, I came to see at a very early stage that a synthesis of Gandhi's method of nonviolence and the Christian ethic of love is the best weapon available to Negroes for their struggle for freedom and human dignity. It may well be that the Gandhian approach will bring about a solution to the race problem in America, Well, this is what he said in 1958 when the movement was on, and of course after that the movement continued and so many laws were passed in the 1960s which indeed gave dignity to the Africans and removed all discrimination on the basis of color, race, religion or national origin. Dr. Martin Luther King continues, "His spirit is a continual reminder to oppressed people that it is possible to resist evil and yet not resort to violence." I'm reminded of what Gandhiji said, "An eye for an eye will only make the whole world blind." Martin Luther King continues, "The Gandhian influence in some way still speaks to the conscience of the world as nations grapple with international problems. If we fail on an international scale to follow the Gandhian principle of nonviolence, we may end up by destroying ourselves through the misuse of our own instruments. The choice is no longer between violence and nonviolence. It is now either nonviolence or non-existence. Oppressed people can deal with oppression in three ways. They can accept or acquiesce. Under segregation, they can adjust to it. Yet, non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. The minute one accepts segregation, one cooperates with it." So this is one way that he said, oppressed people can either just accept, but he says, if you accept, which means you are cooperating with it. And that is the reason why he says non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as it is to cooperate with the good. So this is one option that oppressed people have, Dr. Martin Luther King says. And he says the second, oppressed people can, on the other hand, resort to physical violence, a method both whole nations and oppressed people have used time and again. But violence merely brings about a temporary victory and not permanent peace. It creates ever new problems. The second option, this is the second option that oppressed people have, and this always creates new problems. Albert Einstein said, "I do not know with what weapons the Third World War will be fought, but I do know that the Fourth World War will be fought with sticks and stones." Because the world would have gone back to Stone Age with the kind of weapons that we have now. So after giving these two ways that oppressed people have, then Martin Luther King, in that tribute on the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi Day in 1958 on the 10th anniversary, he said, "The third option is this. Gandhi has come on the scene of history with still another way. He would resist evil as much as the man who uses violence, but he resists it. He resists it without external violence." Or what he does is violence of the spirit. This is what Gandhism does. It is a method of the strong. If the only alternative is between cowardice and violence, it is better, as Gandhi said, to use violence. But there is another way. If the option is between cowardice and violence, yes, you can use violence. But if it is not that, then there is another way. And Dr. Martin Luther King continues, "I myself gained this insight from Gandhi. When I was in theological school, I thought the only way we could solve our problem of segregation was an armed revolt. I felt that the Christian ethic to love was confined to individual relationships. I could not see how it could work in social conflict. Then I read Gandhi's ethic of love as revealed in Jesus, but raised to a social strategy for social transformation. This lifts love from individual relationships to the place of social transformation. This Gandhi helped us to understand, and for this we are grateful. A decade after his death, this is what Martin Luther King said on the 10th anniversary 1958. But I think the world is grateful to Gandhiji for generations. And that is why he's so alive in human consciousness, even till this day. And the most interesting thing is, thanks to this new way demonstrated by Gandhiji and practiced by Dr. Martin Luther King to liberate the oppressed in America, so much work was done on these lines in America. And America, in 2009, for the first time, had a black occupy the highest position of the nation. Mr. Barack Obama became the first African American to become the president of America. No one would have believed if in 1960s or 70s someone suggested that a black would one day rise to the topmost political position of the world. But it happened. It happened in front of our eyes. Nonviolence, truth, they sometimes take time, but they always work. And the heartening thing is this, the first black African American president of United States of America came to India this year, 26 January 2015. As the chief guest of the Republic Day celebrations of India. Happened just a couple of days ago. And do you know what Mr. Barack Obama wrote on the comments book after he landed in India on January 25th, 2015? This is what he wrote. I quote, "What Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said then remains true today. The spirit of Gandhi is very much alive in India today, and it remains a great gift to the world. May we all live in this spirit of love and peace among all people and nations." Unquote. This is what Mr. Barack Obama wrote on his arrival to India. Interestingly, just yesterday, one of India's leading newspapers reported how Mr. N.R. Narayan Murthy, the co-founder of Infosys, India's premier software giants, how Mr. Narayan Murthy and his family have donated £200,000 towards a statue of Mahatma Gandhiji planned to be built at Parliament Square in London. This donation will help the Gandhi Statue Memorial Trust meet its £750,000 target. Lord Meghnad Desai, the non-resident Indian economist who set up this trust to raise funds for this sculpture, said, "This donation once again shows the deep historic links between India and the UK. It also shows the respect that Mahatma Gandhi commands and the importance of having his statue at Parliament Square." This is what Lord Meghnad Desai said. "It was Gandhiji who spearheaded the movement to drive British away from India. And today, his statue is going to stand tall at the center of the political theatre in England." Isn't this amazing? Amazing. Truth and non-violence always endure, they always triumph. As I said, sometimes it might take a while. And Mr. Narayan Murthy, whose contribution is 26.6% of this total cost of this making the statue, he said, "Mahatma Gandhi was someone who demonstrated the tremendous power of leadership by example. His courage and commitment are an inspiration. In 1985, when Bhagwan was speaking to the students in the Institute auditorium on the occasion of Independence Day, Swami said, "Foreign rule was established in India with the help of Indians themselves, unfortunately. Inhabitants of an island 11,000 miles away were able to conquer India, which is 16 times its size and having 8 times its population, and rule over it for 190 years because of one basic defect." Swami said, and that is disunity caused by mutual suspicion, selfishness and jealousy. Unity is strength, union is strength, disunion brings disaster. Swami said this and then he continued. When Gandhi was 24 years old, he proceeded to South Africa at the invitation of an Indian business house to conduct a court case. There he witnessed the humiliation being heaped upon Indian settlers by the whites. Differences, Swami said, can exist between man and man in health, education, wealth and temperament, but fundamentally all men are equal and should be treated as such. But racial animosity was the accepted policy of the white rulers in South Africa then. So Gandhi stayed on among the oppressed Indians and native blacks and devised the strategy of Satyagraha. Satyagraha, which is passive resistance or civil disobedience, to end this exploitation. When the movement showed signs of quick success, General Smuts invited Gandhi for discussion. Gandhi explained to him that he had to resort to non-violent satyagraha since the inhuman policy of insulting and injuring humans having black skins had to be resisted and exterminated. Then General Smuts retorted by pointing out to Gandhi how millions of Indians, who are also human beings like the rest, were kept out of villages and condemned as untouchables. This is a practice that was being followed in India then, the practice of untouchability. And when the general said this, his word acted as a bullet shot right at the heart of Gandhi. Gandhi felt that he had no right to correct another while he was himself infected with the same evil. So he decided to return to India and practice the strategy of Satyagraha for the removal of untouchability and other social evils and to free his motherland from exploitation by foreigners. Satyagraha, Swami says, was the path of truth and love, of the means being as pure as the ends. Verily, he who accepts criticism gladly and thanks the critic for his remarks is the one really human, Swami said. Since Gandhi was willing to learn and had the humility to acknowledge criticism, he could mold the people of his land and be hailed as the father of the nation. And then Bhagwan went on and said, Gandhi looked upon the country as one. He planted the seed of unity of all faiths and all communities, which under his guidance grew quickly into a big tree. He built a great movement on the basis of Atmabalam, that is soul force. And it is this that strengthened unity and self-confidence. This is what Bhagwan said on the occasion of Independence Day, August 15th, to the boys in 1985. What happened around Swami on January 30th, 1948 is really revealing. Swami was 22 years old then. On the afternoon of January 30th, Swami led a few people to Chitravati River as he used to do then very often. But suddenly that day, he ran back to Mandir all of a sudden and then he bolted the door. And he actually stepped in and out of his room intermittently since the afternoon till it was 7:30 in the night. And when he finally came out, he told the devotees around him that a great soul had passed away. Only when the newspaper, the Hindu, India's one of long-standing newspapers, when the newspaper reported the next day that Mahatma, the father of the nation, was assassinated at 5:30 p.m., only then the devotees around Swami then realized why Bhagwan was behaving in a peculiar manner the previous evening. As I told you, Mr. Narayan Murthy said, Mahatma Gandhi was someone who demonstrated the tremendous power of leadership by example. And this happened in the early part of 20th century. The Lord chose to demonstrate the practice of universal love and non-violence through a tremendous soul in the early part of 20th century through the medium of Mahatma Gandhi. He inspired him, he powered him, and he empowered him. But perhaps that was not enough. The world needed more. Perhaps the problems of the current times are so grave that the universal creator, the divine mother, could not rest content sending his message through a messenger, and so he himself descended. And that is how this remarkable 20th century saw the very source of love and non-violence, the very fountain of love and peace, manifest in flesh and blood and physically demonstrate how to lead a life of love, how to walk on the path of truth, how to march on the highway of non-violence, and how to adhere to the principles of right conduct with patience, with perseverance, and with purity. That is what we saw for 86 years, the golden period of our lives, the golden period of 20th and 21st century. And to capture this, to document this, and to learn how to adapt this teachings in our lives, we have started a series in Radio Sai called Learning with Love. In this series, we ask people who have had invaluable moments with Swami to share the indelible lessons of love that they have learned living with Swami, watching Swami, working under His direction. Lessons that have become life lessons, lessons that have refined and redirected their lives. And today, I wish to play for you one such conversation that I had with Professor Sudhir Bhaskar in August 2014. And as you hear this, I will pause it at some points and share my thoughts even as he gives his insights from the experiences that he had with Bhagwan. So this is what we will do in this last lap of Thursday Life, coming to you straight from the studios of Radio Sai.
Tune into Sai. Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai.
So welcome to Outside Inside, Deep Inside, and I'm Team Radio Sai's Vishu. The time in the studios now is 8:59, and today we have, as I just mentioned, Learning with Love, anecdotes and insights from Professor Sudhir Bhaskar, from the times he has spent with Bhagwan. So I'm going to play for you this interview that I had with him. And when he completes narrating one lesson, we will pause and discuss. I will make a few comments, share with you what I gathered from what he said. And you too, dear listeners, if you have any thoughts, please feel free to write to us. As always, you can send your mails to listener@radiosai.org. So let's begin. Here is the first excerpt of the conversation with Professor Sudhir Bhaskar. So this is how the conversation began. Sairam, dear listeners, I'm Team Radio Sai's Bishu, and I'm delighted to welcome you to our occasional series, Learning with Love. Learning with Love is a variant of our Tryst with Divinity conversations with a value-added component. It is a sort of a Tryst with Divinity series, but with a twist. The difference is, in these interviews, people who have been touched by the love of Bhagwan share the lessons that they have learned from their association with Swami in clear, concise and candid manner, so that that take-home message for us is conveyed in no ambiguous terms. And listening to their life experiences with Swami and how they have made these lessons their mantras for life, we can learn to live and replicate these precious principles in our lives too. And I am indeed honored to have in the studio now for this special episode of Learning with Love, Professor Sudhir Bhaskar, a very familiar and spirited inmate of the Prashanti Nilayam Ashram. He's known for his enthusiasm, his energy, initiative, innovation, planning, perfect execution, and above all, being such a blessed instrument of Bhagwan, to whom Swami from time to time entrusted many crucial and extremely important and prized responsibilities. Someone who has walked with Bhagwan, someone who has seen those facets of Swami which only those who have had the chance to serve the Lord at very close quarters will get to witness. Someone who has had his share of moments of supreme ecstasy and cataclysmic agony too. Someone who has been personally and directly chiseled by the Lord to make him the exceptional figure he is today. Today is August 30th, 2014, and until recently, he was the director of the Prashanti Nilayam campus of Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning. Earlier, he was the dean of the Department of Management Studies here in Prashanti Nilayam. He has more than 3 decades of teaching, research and consulting experience in the areas of quality management, re-engineering, marketing electives, complex problem-solving, corporate social responsibility and rural development, and so on. After his bachelor's in engineering in REC Warangal, which is now called NIT, he did his master's in technology from the prestigious IIT Madras, and he topped it with a fellowship in management, which is equivalent to PhD, from IIM Bangalore. So again, all his degrees come from very, very premier institutes of the country. And before joining Bhagwan's University in 1988, he worked for 6 years in TCS, Tata Consultancy Services, one of India's leading companies in IT and IT services. Plenty of awards and accolades have come his way. He was awarded the Rashtriya Gaurav Award and the Certificate of Excellence by India International Friendship Society in 2011. One of the research scholars under his supervision was adjudged Outstanding Doctoral Management Student Award 2010 by AIIMS International, which is Association of Indian Management Scholars International. He has over 45 publications in referred national and international journals. He is a visiting faculty in the Indian Institute of Science, Bangalore, in IIPM, Bangalore, Institute of Administration, Hyderabad, and so on. The list is long. But as I said before, more than all this, what is special about him is this exceptional relationship that he shared with Bhagwan at the physical level, working and serving him at a level which very few people have got to witness and experience. And that is something very unique, very precious, and immensely pertinent for you, for me, and for posterity. And it is this, dear listeners, that we want to capture today, at least some glimpses of it. I forgot to mention that he is the one who is to always take the lead under Bhagwan's direct supervision to guide the planning and execution of the Sri Sathya Sai Grama Seva project. You know, every year, all the students of Bhagwan's institutions go out and serve in the villages, in the surrounding areas during the Dasara season, and he has been the one instrumental in organizing this mammoth project for the boys leading from the front. So, with great pleasure, without saying any more words, I welcome you, sir, to Learning with Love. Thank you so much for being with us in the studios.
Sairam to all. Thank you, Bishu. I think, you know, you have used more words than, you know, I really deserve. Why I say that is, what I am today was only possible by His divine will, by His grace and His love, which He has been showering on me and my family for the last, I would say, close to 55 years.
55 years, that's a long time.
Those late 50s onwards.
Yes.
But of course, a very small child at that time. I mean, that could be a different interview by itself.
Yes.
But my interaction, though I had my interviews with Swami much before, I was very serious follower and a practitioner of what Swami was saying from the year 1977 when I joined the Sevadal.
As the Sevadal and Satya Seva organization.
Yeah. At that time I was working in Baroda and I got enrolled here during Shivratri celebrations.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the time when I got an opportunity to sit behind Swami Jula.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And also have the privilege of, you know, singing the Jula.
Yes.
Which, you know, normally, you know, it was very rare.
Rare.
And it became much rare after 1995 because 1995 was the last time Swami sat in the Jula.
Jula.
And I'm really pleased to mention that that was the last time when Swami sat. I also was behind Swami's Jula.
Yeah, I know.
And had the greatest blessings of Bhagwan.
Mm.
And one other thing was the interaction which he used to have when Swami was sitting in the Jula and looking back and giving instructions whether the swing should be a little faster, slower.
Oh, okay.
How much more it should be and all that. You know, that's a really thrilling moment. Mm. Because that can be separate topic for discussion. When you mentioned about this topic, what actually occurred to me is that in English literature, most of them analyze either the authors or the characters which they are trying to portray based on three aspects, three lives as we call it, the public life, the private life, and something, you know, which people those days and even now dread is the secret life of the individual.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I say that, you know, public life and private life everybody knows is all public. The secret life is something, you know, which the individual whom we are analyzing would like to keep it secret.
Mm.
Because it has a wrong connotation or a negative connotation with him. And he would not like to be reminded about it. So he would like to keep it in the farthest recess of his memory so that he never tries to visit it. But as human psychology is that, no, these are the things which have a reflection both on the public and private life. So though we don't know his secret life, but looking and understanding these two aspects, they are able to get the glimpse of what his secret life is.
Mm-hmm.
In English literature, most often than not, they look at it more as a negative of what has happened or what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when it comes to, I analyzed it looking at, in the life of a devotee, or a serious sadhaka, also we have these three lives. We have the public life, we also have the private life. But more importantly, we also have the secret life. And what is the secret life? The secret life is not like what we are discussing like English literature, something which you dread. On the contrary, for a serious sadhaka, these are most cherished, most memorable, most valued, and most remembered by him.
Perhaps so precious that he wants to keep it just to himself.
But they are the defining moments in his personal life and to himself, which occasionally gets reflected in his private life and possibly into his public life.
Beautiful.
Now, the point is which I'm trying to drive is the secret life which you are talking about, which is so enamoring and so beautiful. The thing is, he does not like to share it for the simple reason that not that he is going to lose it. Possibly because the people are going to listen may not understand it.
Exactly.
Because all these moments have got a relationship to his life and the context in which it happens.
Yes.
What you call samayam sandarbham, Swami calls it. Based on that, it makes a meaning.
Yes.
And if even I, if I...
In isolation, they may not
understand or appreciate as much as it exactly. Made an impact on the individual life.
Yes.
And individuals.
Yes.
So, if he was to tell all those things, it will take almost 3-4 hours just to tell one aspect and people lose interest.
Correct.
So that is the thing which you know. But after you asked me about it, what I was thinking is, possibly in the last 3 years, the time has come, at least those who are willing should be able to open up themselves. At least share those moments with Swami which they had. And more importantly, how the learning of that made an impact on the individual to change. Because Swami, when he takes an avatar, he has come with a purpose. And that purpose purely is transformation. All other things are added to it. Now you look at Rama avatar, Krishna avatar, any avatar you look at, there are other things which are added. But the core of all that is only one thing, which is transformation. So in that type of situation, if you look at these defining moments which we talk about for an individual, apart from us who are Swami's devotees, it could also be based on what you call a master, a guru, or divinity himself. And we can find a lot of these examples when we discuss individually of those people who are serious sadhakas, that you know, they had had those defining moments. Why I'm saying is, it's necessary for us to share is, at least this will enthuse the people who are listening to go forward in the direction of sadhana.
Yes.
And you take the first step, as Swami says, he's going to do the next 100 steps. But the first thing which Swami expects is you take the first step. So I only personally feel maybe these are some of the things which can really inspire the people.
Absolutely.
How it can really make a small, it may be small, it may be a small change in you. But how the small changes make such a big thing over a period of time. And many times, you know, we see things happen, we look at it, observe it and forget it, not realizing that it is meant for us to learn something from that. So one of the ideas which I have is, maybe through this, it may be incident, maybe a simple small thing, but it communicates something if you are really interested in learning and being able to change in you. I thought that could be the one of the reasons. I mean,
definitely.
The way I look at it, because I'm a faculty member by profession.
Yes.
So I always look at, whoever is going to be an audience or whoever is listening to me.
I think what you're sharing is absolutely so relevant, because I think the time has come, as you mentioned, to come out with all those experiences which have redefined our spiritual journey, which have given proper direction on our spiritual path. And as you very rightly said, there are so many who would really benefit, because everybody is on that path and everybody is looking for direction. And those of us who have had the chance to get this directly from Swami,
correct,
once we share, I think so many people will be able to relate to it, they'll be able to hold on to it and, get inspiration and courage and confidence to move on the path. So,
and also, Swami has many times has said, to whom much is given, much is expected.
Yes.
In our case, or others also who are like us, what is much expected from them? One, practice it first.
Yes.
Through their practice and their actions, preach. Not through words. I thought these are the things, which is demanded of us.
Yes.
As of now. And there are a number of examples. There are a number of simple people who have been practicing it. And they are becoming inspirations for a lot of other people around.
Absolutely.
You go to any town, any samiti, any area, you will find such people are already there.
Gems, really. Yeah.
And I mean, that list is so long, we can't even compile it. As I mentioned, in 76, I joined a company in Baroda, now called Vadodara. And 77, I came to have Swami's darshan for Shivratri. And that day, after seeing that Lingodbhavam, it was so thrilling.
Hmm.
I mentally made up my mind that, Swami, come what may, every year, when you are in Puttaparthi, first Shivratri I will come.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go some other place, I am from a lower middle class family, I can't afford to go anywhere around so easily. So that was the resolution I made. I said, Swami, my intention is there. It is for you to make it to happen. And from that time onwards, almost on a daily basis, some miracle or other used to happen in my life.
Mm-hmm.
That place, because I used to stay alone there. And it was something, a different world itself. But the one which I would like to narrate is, after I became Sevadal, every Sunday we used to go to the Maharaja Sayaji General Hospital for service. And we used to go between 3 and 4, when we used to go to a ward which was called as orthopedics ward.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why the organization chose that was that week after week if you go, an orthopedic patient is likely to be in the hospital for 3-4 weeks. So there's a possibility for us to see him or her and interact and bring about a small, you know, solace in them.
More chance of continued interaction.
And second thing is, these are the places where it's unlikely there will be any infection.
Mm-hmm.
You will not communicate to them, nor will they communicate to you. You go to any infectious or no other wards, government will not allow, the doctors will not allow, because you don't know what you are going to bring it to them.
Correct.
So that was the basic intention. One Sunday when we went, since we were already familiar with the people, and then we saw in one bed there was a new person who has been an inpatient. So we just looked at the person and we found he was slightly elderly and he was just, you know, late 20s, a young fellow, not married. And along with him was there's a brother and sister-in-law. So as usual, you know, we used to go and say Sairam and then find out, you know, what happened. We found that his left leg was amputated.
Mm-hmm.
So we just casually, just, you know, start the conversation, we asked him what happened. The brother was saying that no, he was going along in the tractor and he slipped and fell down and wheel went over his leg and from a rural village and there was no way they could provide any treatments and they had to do the amputation in the local whatever hospital was there. And as part of post-op care, they were not able to take care properly and there was a lot of infection. So they suggested they come to this general hospital. So that's how he got admitted. So we told a few nice words, you know, just to prep them up so they'll be able to bear it. The following week when we went, he was little down. Then he showed his hand saying that, no, look, there's a lot of anemia which is setting in. I'm not getting proper treatment. Please help us. We are Sevadal, we have got certain rules. We don't interfere with the type of medical treatment which is being done, whatever drug administration has been done. Because the moment we start interfering, then the hospital authority will say, please find your way out. That was not the intention. Then we said, don't worry, it will happen like this. But no, I'm quite sure the doctors who are looking after, they are very eminent people, they know what they're doing. Told them that no, it will take time because it doesn't go off so easily. Be patient. The following week when we went, we found that he was more desperate. Pain was high, nothing was happening. He was becoming pale. Almost, at breakdown point, he said, sir, please help us. Please talk to the doctors. If the medicines are not available in the hospital, better medicines are needed, please ask them to tell us. Either we will buy it and after begging some money from somebody, or people like you could help us out. Please help us. Please help us. Though however much we may be wanting to do certain things, it's not so easy to do it. So, but now we told something. We said, okay, we'll find out. Do whatever is possible. But don't worry. We'll be taken care. And we gave him the vibhuti packet and told nice things. The following week when we went, that means the fourth week, we found all three of them were very cheerful.
Oh.
So, we thought maybe our prayers
and
maybe their resilience, whatever it, or maybe the doctors themselves have done something, thought there was a turnaround. When we went to find out details, his condition was same as last week. Mm-hmm. There was no change in his medical condition.
Physical condition.
Physical condition. But he was little, all three of them were better.
Mm-hmm.
Mood-wise, mentally. So we thought, what is this transformation which has taken place in them? So I asked them, hey, what happened? Then they said, see sir, who's on my bedside? Neighbor. We saw, few days before only, I believe, a baby which was less than 12 weeks was on the cot and was having a traction on the right leg.
Oh my God.
Because there was a hip dislocation. In medical terminology, if you're putting a traction, you know what they do? Below the knee, they'll put a rod through the bone.
Oh my God, for an infant.
And then they put a pulley and at the end of the pulley, they put weight so that the whole thing gets, because it's dislocation, the bone has to be stretched so it'll come back to position so that it can fit into the original location. And we saw the end, the weight was 16 bricks, 12 weeks old baby. Having a weight at the end, 16 bricks. I mean, all of us almost broke down. Okay, we have not heard, but seeing it. So we asked the mother, "Mother, what happened? Such a small child, hip dislocation." Then she was saying, few days before, she was sitting on the ground, on the floor, with a baby in the lap, and doing cooking. Suddenly she had to bend to lift the vessel because it was overflowing. In the process of bending and lifting, the baby rolled over her lap.
Oh no.
So what's the gap between the lap and the ground? 4 inches, 5 inches, 6 inches? That means baby just rolled over and fell. And in that fall, had the hip dislocation. If you ask anybody, any doctor, for such a young child, it's impossible to have anything, because even if the child falls from 10 feet or 12 feet, normally, because of the plasticity of the body and the bones and everything, normally 80 to 90% of the time nothing happens to the child. This is only about 6 inches. Mother said we got dislocated. We went to the local quack and others. They couldn't do anything, so we brought the child here. Then this person was saying, the young boy's brother, saying, look, the child is just 12 weeks old. What bad thing could it have done in this life for to have the suffering? Is the suffering only to the child? Suffering to the mother. Suffering to all the family members. What bad could it have done? And when I look at my brother, who is about 20 plus, possibly in this life he would have done so many things wrong, for which now he is, the word, you know, bhoktara, that means he is going through all the particular thing which he has been. And then you find, it is not because of what you did today. Possibly the child must have done something in the previous birth. And then he said, if that is the case, what about my own son, brother? And the child, you know, after some time, you know, it was laughing and then moving his hands and leg and other things, because the other leg, you know, which is in the traction of the stretcher, it can't move. But all other things, it was able to move and then smile and other things. If that child with that much of pain is able to enjoy, why we cannot? See, this is all purely based on karma. And the lesson for us was that if we can bear this with a smile, it makes that much more bearable and possibly cure much faster.
Yes.
And the following week went, he was already discharged.
Already discharged. Wow.
That means, you know, what it says, you know, like, you know, Swami always says, you do it with a little bit of love, with little concern, and little bit of, you know, that extra you give, the miracles will happen. Because yes. Swami wants the first step. So that he will take the rest of the 99 steps, 100 steps to correct. Make the change. So that day, of course, I have not read much of, you know, Swami's literature and philosophy and other things, because meaning engineering and other things, you know, your head is full of those number systems. Then that was the thing which gave me a lesson of what karma theory is. And if this is what we had to go through it, why not we go through it willingly?
Willingly. Absolutely. You benefit more in every way.
And not only you. If you are happy or smiling or, you know, wearing, then the other members of the family who have not been responsible for your act of your previous birth or whenever it was, they also become happy to go through the whole process.
Yes.
So this was a very great lesson which I learnt in 77.
Take everything with a smile. Whatever is happening to you, there is no other way it could have happened.
In fact, once Swami told, after one incident which happened in 1991, not a pleasant one, Swami said that, look, I was physically present there when this event was happening in your life. It had to happen. Otherwise, I didn't intervene.
Swami told you that. It had to happen.
On another occasion, Swami was interacting with us. Swami said that, look, please understand, once you surrender to me, I will never allow anything wrong to happen to you. Please take it, whatever happens is only good for your life.
Only good for your life. Wow.
It just brings about a totally different way of looking at life and events which are happening, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's powerful, sir. Once you surrender to me, you know that whatever is happening, it is good for you.
It is best for you.
It is best for you.
And once Swami also said in Telugu, but I'll tell in English, even in your dream, even by mistake, you say once, Swami, I'm yours, you are mine. And after making the statement, he says, Sorry, Swami, I made a mistake. I want to withdraw the statement. Swami said, once it has come out of your lips, I will hold on to you for rest of the time. You are under me, you cannot be out of me. Look at whatever assurance Swami has given.
Phenomenal.
And couple it with what we are talking about, the lesson of both karma theory as well as the protection Swami is giving, says that I will not allow anything wrong to happen to you unless that is the best for you. The incident in 91 was not a pleasant one for us. But on hindsight, after the event, after some years, we found that no, possibly that's the best thing which could have happened. But can we? But the point is, because we are seekers, we are sadhakas, when we are going through that particular event, going through that particular phase, can we take in the right spirit? And Swami always expects us that.
Yes.
Because does Swami like any of us to be morose in front of him? Or some called castile faces?
He hated castile faces.
Okay, that's the word. Why? Because if you feel bad something happened to you, please understand Swami is feeling 100 times more bad about what has happened to you.
That is amazing.
And if you really love him, would you like him to go through it?
So
this was the type of lesson which I learned with just a simple one. A baby, 12 weeks old. I've been in and out of hospitals as a patient, as a Sevadal fellow who was serving. And all the medical camps which are conducted in Puttaparthi by Andhra Pradesh, I was always a volunteer who used to come. I've seen a lot of sufferings. Not that I've not seen. But point, this had made so much of impact on me. And especially the interpretation that young man gave about karma theory, I think it really stuck to me.
Yes. All those experiences, once you came to Bhagwan and got more clarity about life and the karma and God's assurance, I think all the things became even more clear and even more confirmed in you.
More than that, it actually gives me a lot of satisfaction that, look, I have finally come to a person whom people call God or whatever it may be, who has got the capacity and ability to take care of such things which are beyond human comprehension.
Absolutely.
And since we cannot understand anything, and then the only person who can tell us something about it is only God, because He is the creator of everything else. So that is the reason why, you know, we say. But nevertheless, I mean, the joy which I get, I came in 88, as you have mentioned it. From that day till date, as you put, I have the same enthusiasm to go to Mandir.
Really?
I am the first person then, I am the first person even now.
Absolutely, I mean, that never changes in you.
Why? I am not trying to boast about myself. If that is the type of thing which I got by doing at that time all the joy of being with Swami and Swami showering so much on me, why should I not do it today? People may say that, no, He's not there. I always tell them, for me He's there. You are not able to see, I am able to see it. I am able to see Him. He interacts with me, He talks to me, He answers all my questions. More than that, He solves all my problems. Why did we all come to God in the first place? Because we came with only baggage, isn't it?
Yes.
The bundles of problems, and we want Him to solve. That's how everybody has come. There is no person I know who has come only as a, you know, for a pure joy they have come. So if that is the case, even now when He's taking care, why should I not be doing it? I'll tell you a few more things now as we go down.
Sure.
Which really confirms that, no, one, He's there. Second one is that He's taking care. So that's the one which, no, I would like to impress on people.
Sure.
Especially people who have not had the benefit of seeing Swami and interacting with Him. For them also it's going to be reassurance. It's a reassurance for all of them that, no, look, you still have Him. He still will do what you want. But please remember, what He does is for your best.
Absolutely. Whatever you experience in life, once you have come to Him, once you have surrendered to Him, know that it is for
that
you.
Surrender is not people wait till telling, say, no, Swami, I'll do whatever you say. That is not, I'm not talking about this surrender. The surrender which I gave you the thing, even out of mistake, in my mind, in a dream, I slipped and told that, Swami, I'm yours and you are mine.
That's it.
That is surrender. That aspect we are able to hold, that is the end of it. And you will not let
God is
go.
Just waiting to
for you to make that slip. Let us put it that way.
Well, I mean, no limit to the compassion, that's why.
That's why, when you say Swami is 1,000 mothers, that's what it really means, isn't it?
So that was Professor Sudhir Bhaskar, the former director of the Prashant Nilayam campus. This is just one part of the first conversation that I had with him for this series, Learning with Love. And if you look at the learnings from the episode that he mentioned, of the chance he got to serve in that hospital in Baroda, and the life-changing insight that he derived, I feel the first lesson from this episode is the lesson of sensitivity, isn't it? It was his willingness to serve that had happened after he met Bhagwan. The transformation happened because he wanted to serve, because he took time out to serve. And once he did that, once he stepped onto that path, see what that did to him. And this is what service and sensitivity does to each one of us. Recently I read a very moving account in an international newspaper. It is about a 8-year-old boy from Rwanda. His name is Justus Uweshu. Life, indeed, survival was very difficult for this boy. And Sundays were particularly very difficult. You know the reason why? Because the garbage trucks did not run on Sundays. And if the garbage trucks did not run on Sundays, it meant that there would be no food for him. Because he lived next to the Kigali city dump. He lived as a double orphan. During the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi community in Rwanda, Justice's father was executed for being born into a family whose identity card had the Tutsi box arbitrarily checked. Just because he was a Tutsi, his father was mercilessly killed, and after this his mother vanished. He had no clue where his mother went. Most probably she would have met with the same fate, because otherwise she would have never willingly abandoned her 2-year-old child, Justice. By the time Justice was 8, he had meandered more than 100 kilometers. And finally he ended up in the garbage dump for Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. And amidst that stench was the buffet he ate from every day. You know what was his home? His home was a stripped out tireless car in which he slept on and under pieces of cardboard. The car had no windows, but it provided some protection from the rain and the equatorial sun. And you know who were his competition for food? It was the pigs. The pigs also preferred the waste that came from restaurants and hotels. Justice fought with them, separated out the bottle caps, the toothpicks, soiled napkins and other disgusting things before finding some scraps of food for himself. And Sunday was most disappointing because the garbage trucks did not run on Sundays. And one Sunday, one such terrible Sunday, the traditional day of disappointment and hunger, something else happened. On that dusty road came a taxi, and in the taxi was Miss Claire Effiong, a visitor from the United States. Miss Claire was on a mission. She said that she was being led by the Spirit. She did not know why she was in Rwanda, but she just knew that that Spirit had led her to Rwanda and on to that dirt road in that particular taxi on that Sunday. And when Claire saw a particular group of children, he could make out they were all OVCs. OVCs are orphans and vulnerable children. When Claire saw this group, she told the taxi driver, "Stop." And then through an interpreter, Claire engaged the children in conversation and he asked them, "What do you want?" And the usual response that these children always gave, "We want money." Someone said, "I want clothes." Someone said, "I want boots," and things like that. But when Miss Claire asked the 8-year-old justice, "What do you want?" he said, "I want to go to school." And the moment Claire heard this, she asked justice to get into the taxi. Like the good Samaritan who took the beaten and battered traveler to the inn for treatment and rest, Claire drove justice to a friend's home in Gikondo, a town in Rwanda, and he told her friend, "Please educate this boy. This boy wants to go to school. Please educate this boy and I will send you the money to pay for his school fees, for his school materials, for his uniform and shoes. Whatever is needed, I will support." And from his very first day of school, you know what has been the distinctive attribute of justice? His most unique attribute has been, and it still remains, is his ever-present conviction that it is a precious privilege. It is a precious privilege to learn and study his way out of poverty. When Claire pulled justice from the city garbage dump, he spoke only Kinyarwanda, which is the local language in Rwanda. By the time he graduated from high school, justice was speaking 5 languages. But languages were not his focus. He had actually become a brilliant maths and chemistry student, and he was selected to join 30 students out of 1200 applicants in the Bridge to Rwanda Scholars Program that prepares Rwanda's most gifted and promising students to successfully compete for international scholarships. So just as obsessively studied for TOEFL and SAT, which are these exams that you have to write to find colleges and universities in United States to pursue higher studies. So he studied English, research and writing, leadership, entrepreneurship, discipleship. He tried to work hard. And in the month of March, the March madness is not about basketball for him. For him, it was about college admission. And on the decision day at 11 p.m., Rwandan time, that was the day he would know the results of his months of hard work. Justice came to his home to use the internet and see what is in store for him. He fumbled and struggled to get into the secure admission site because he was very anxious. And as he clicked, the letter began to load. And the first word Justice read was, "Congratulations." Justice screamed with joy and fell to the floor. You know why? Because when he composed himself, he could not believe what he saw. He immediately took the phone and called Miss Claire in the US and said, Mom, you know what? I am going to Harvard. That is what he did. He indeed went to Harvard. fact. It is not just justice. There's another classmate of justice who also went to Harvard. And there are many others who were admitted to Dartmouth, to University of Chicago, to the Northwestern, to Berkeley, to Michigan State, and so many highly selective schools. This article was written by Mr. T.P. Allen, who is a former LA attorney, and now he is the country director of Bridge to Rwanda. And in the article, he says, "When I reflect on this highly improbable story, I think of the butterfly effect, wherein a small cause in one place has such a huge effect somewhere else. As they say, a butterfly fluttering in one corner of the world could actually cause a storm in another corner of the world." This is what happened in this story. Claire and many such good folks who gave hand up to justice along the way ensured that he moved from garbage dump to Harvard's glory. He says, "Too often we are seduced into taking great comfort in the self-deception that problems are too big and too many and we cannot make a difference. But these good folks in justice life knew that they could and should make a contribution from whatever they had, and as a result, justice went to Harvard." And look at justice. He passionately and emphatically knows and believes the unmerited favor that has been lavished upon him. And he feels that what has been done for him, he must now do for others. If he denies the poor, he will deny himself. And self-affirmation requires him to pay it forward, and that is what he is doing. Today he is helping other children of Rwanda get education. And this author of this article, Mr. Allen, says, "As I continue on my wandering journey in Rwanda, I want to be like Miss Claire and know when to tell the taxi driver, stop. I want the necessary discernment and courage to respond to the opportunity before me and to act." Isn't that beautiful? If only we know when to pause. If only we know when to stop our lives so that so many lives can begin. If only when we know how to once just reflect and not respond but react meaningfully, we would be adding meaning to so many lives. And Mr. Allen in that article finally says, "I'm often asked, why are you in Rwanda?" As I told you, he's the country director of Bridge to Rwanda. And he says, "I have many deeply embraced answers. But after spending these recent days with Justice and other Bridge to Rwanda scholars," he says, "if someone asks me why I'm in Rwanda, this is what I tell them now. Living in Rwanda is more thrilling than watching the best, most powerful, most emotionally rich and raw movies imaginable. And I actually get to have unvarnished, intimate conversations with the great actors as they are performing." For him, it is the most thrilling movie that he is seeing in real life. He says sometimes those conversations may even color and sharpen the performance. But finally, he says, "Whether or not I influence the performance always impacts and transforms me. I can hardly believe that I get to do this. Each day I arise with joy and wonder of yet another day." As Professor Sudhir Bhaskar said, what that seva did to him as far more significant than what he could do to others in the seva. And it's the same experience for Mr. Allen, who works at Bridge to Rwanda. He says what transformation that it does to him is incomparable. And that is what sensitivity does to us. That is what happens when we feel for the other. There is a story of a professor of an engineering college who gave a general knowledge test, and in the end the question that he asked of all the boys is, what is the name of the sweeper of our institute? And most of them, in fact all of them, left the last question unanswered. And in fact, before the lesson ended, another student inquired if the last question would be marked. Does it have credits? And the professor replied, certainly. Do you know why? Because you will meet many people in your life and all of them will have some degree of importance. They will deserve your attention, even if it is a simple smile or a simple hello. You have to be sensitive to everyone around. You have to respect everyone you meet. And this person who shared this story says, from that day I never forgot the name of that sweeper. His name was Raghu. On another momentous day in 2005, July 26, 2005, a rainy day in Mumbai, a frail man was standing on the roadside in knee-deep water. His car had broken down and he was desperately in need of help. He was wet to his core and he signaled to passers-by. A young man stopped to help him out. He pushed his car to a safe place. He called a mechanic and he hailed an auto for him. The frail old man seemed too much in a hurry, but he did not forget to thank him and he took down his address on a piece of paper. 7 days had already passed when someone knocked at the door of that young man. And to his enormous surprise, it was a courier with a huge packet to deliver. It was an iMac computer and Philips music system with a note, "Many thanks for helping me on the road that night. The rain had completely drenched me and my soul when you appeared. Thanks to you, I was able to reach my dying wife just in time. God bless you for having helped me. Sincerely, Dr. P.K. Singhania." We don't know how one simple act of ours could make such an indelible impression. How it could give someone a lifetime of memory. Some time ago, when the ice creams were not so expensive, a 10-year-old boy went to Nirula's ice cream shop. And while sitting at the table, he asked the waiter, "How much does a sundae cost?" And the waiter said, "Rupees 40. So the boy took out his money from the pocket and he began counting it. Then he asked, "Okay, well, how much does a simple ice cream cost?" Now there were other people who were waiting to be served, so the waiter, he became a little impatient and he said, "30 rupees. So the boy now counted his money again and he said, "Okay, please get me a simple ice cream." So the waiter served him the ice cream and the bill. The boy ate the ice cream and he paid his bill at the cash counter and left. When the waiter went to clean the table, he began to cry. Because in the corner of the plate was rupees 10, his tips. This boy, for rupees 40, could have had an exotic ice cream, but he chose to have a simple ice cream so that he could give that 10 rupees as tip. This is what sensitivity is all about. The other great lesson that we learn from this episode that Professor Sudhir Bhaskar said is this lesson of gratitude. To be grateful for what we are. They say if we learn to count our blessings, then so much blessing will be showered on us that it will become uncountable. As they say, I cried for a pair of shoes till I saw someone with one leg. Sometime back I got this foreword which said, if you have never experienced the danger of war or the solitude of imprisonment or the agony of torture and hunger, you are much ahead of 500 million people who live in this world. And we complain about so many things. If you have food in your refrigerator, clothes to wear, a roof on your head and a place to sleep, you are richer than 75% of the people who live on this earth. If you can go to your place of worship without being threatened, arrested, tortured or killed, you are luckier than 3 billion people of this world. If you have money in your bank account and your wallet and also some loose change in some little box, you are one of the world's 8% well-to-do population. If you are able to listen to this message, if you are able to read, if you have someone who can understand, and read and write, you are not one of those 2 billion people who are illiterate. If only we learn to count our blessings, there would never be a day of sorrow in our lives. And only when that young man learned to count his blessings, smile blossomed, and once his smile blossomed, his body healed. And then everything was fine. Everything will become fine. They say we should work as if we have no need of that money. We should love as if no one has ever made us suffer. We should dance as if no one is watching us, and we should sing as if everyone is cheering us, and we should live as if the paradise is on earth. Of course, the other very important lesson from what Professor Sudhir Bhaskar said is the lesson of surrender. And that is something which we'll discuss more in detail in the future episodes of this program, Learning with Love, Anecdotes and Insights from Professor Sudhir Bhaskar. This is the first part of this program. Maybe we'll continue this in the next episode of Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. Thank you so much for being with us. Please do write to us and tell us what you felt, what you feel about this program. It is our endeavor all the time to ensure that in some ways we live in our lives that lives up to what Bhagwan said, love all, serve all, help ever, hurt never. This is what is engraved on Bhagwan's Sannidhi in the Sai Kulwant Hall, and this is what we need to remind ourselves every single moment of our existence. So dear listeners, thank you so much for being with us all throughout the day. I'm Team Radio Sai Bishu. And it's time to draw the curtains on this day-long Thursday life we offer this whole series of programs with gratitude at the lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan. As always, you can write to us by emailing to listener@radiosai.org. And as I sign off, you will continue to listen to a drama by children and youth from the United States, which is presented in front of Bhagwan on 25th June 2003. The name of this program is There Is Only One Religion. So, continue to listen to this and let us spend our lives in love. In love, with Sai, for Sai, in Sai. Thank you so much. Sai Ram.